degrees, mostly cloudy. In New York City, 41 degrees and sunny. From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Here in New York City, you're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. It's 12 noon. Coming up next, The Gary Null Show.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show.
Hello.
Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how higher magnesium levels in your blood are associated with greater brain volume, low risk of cerebrovascular disease. That will help everyone of all ages. So that's good. This is from Emory University. That's just one of the many important health and healing and anti-aging piece of advice we'll be sharing today. Always from peer-reviewed journals, always from respected institutions. Now, why these are not promoted in the mainstream media, I cannot answer that. But that's the positive side of this equation. Also today, we'll be hearing from two professors, two evolutionary biologists, good scientists, who are questioning the PCR test. Why? But think of it. The PCR test was the test that everyone in America, in fact, around the world had to take. It were various types, but the one in the United States was universal, meaning everyone had to take it. And then people were given all of these, well, you're infected, you're infected. Everybody was infected. But then they found that it was an inaccurate test, and they explain it. It's only a four-minute interview. It is so good. And then the CDC decides to agree with them and stops using it. Just a few weeks ago, in fact, not even 2 weeks ago, the CDC told the FDA, stop using the PCR test that we've been using for the last 2 years. They're going to use other tests that are more accurate. No comments at all in the mainstream media. None. Wouldn't you think this was important? That the very basis of establishing the quantifiable numbers of how many people are infected and therefore ill should be debated, discussed. And now they're saying, nothing to see here. We got it wrong. All of it. And the testing was wrong. How bad was it? We're estimating up to 90% of all the people who were told they were positive were not, based upon how many amplifications. I'm not going to go into it now. They're going into it, but we were right all along because we were the only radio program, the only mainstream media that, let's say, none of the mainstream media talked about this. They all said it was accurate. We said it wasn't. Now, why don't you take some time today, if you have it, and go to GaryNull.com or PRN and download the interview I did. It's a long interview. There are versions of it all over the internet. Jimmy Dore just had one, and everywhere you look, you'll see Kerry Mullis sitting there being interviewed by me in 1996. And at that time, he was saying, do not use this for diagnosing. It's not meant for that. It can't tell you whether you've got a flu virus or some other virus or a cold virus. In any case, we've been using it in the wrong way, and he won the Nobel Prize for discovering it. So this gives you the full interview, and it talks about the corruption of science. It's well worth watching. But also today, we're going to take on an issue where people are saying, well, on the one hand, New York and Washington State, Oregon, are publishing some articles in journals showing that it is the unvaccinated who are the sickest and are entering the hospitals. Okay. That's what their journals are showing. Richard Gale will be here to show you why that is not accurate. We will break down with actual articles showing you how we've all been misled. Now, possibly unintentionally misled. I'm not suggesting any untoward or somehow corrupt motivation for it. The people writing the articles, including peer review articles, themselves were using misinformation. And then I promised at the beginning of the year that I would start the year with a series of essays, a series of commentaries that would explore the world we live in today, where we're at in our society, how we're evolving or de-evolving, how we're progressing or regressing. This will be the final one in that series. This is 7 in a row. They're posted on GaryNall.com. If you find them of value, if you find that they have merit, then please share them as broadly as you can. Because if they make sense to you, it's possible they make sense to other people who only know one side of the story. They don't know that there's another whole understanding of the crisis we're going through and how may we be able to reshape and refocus and repurpose our energies to have a more positive outcome for all of us. I want to see all of us live in harmony together. I don't want to see prejudice. I don't want to see bias. I don't want to see hatred. I don't want to see animosity. I don't want to see racism. I don't want to see anti-racists who are actually promoting racism. I don't want to see people who are separated. I don't want to see the balkanization of America. That's why I'm doing these series. And each one is different, all approaching the problem from different perspectives. That's our program today. And we're going to set time aside for your calls. Now, we begin the latest on health and healing. Emory University published an article in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrients, and they wanted to see, was there an association between a higher intake of serum magnesium levels and greater brain volume? Because one thing we know, as you age, your brain shrinks. That's not good. We become dehydrated. That's really not good, because so many different biochemical and electrical charging elements in our body are based upon our hydration level. In fact, one of the very first things that I do when people come to an anti-aging clinical study is we check their body composition for body mass index. This is their fat content, muscle content, bone density, and weight, and then water content. Because I noticed a long time ago when I was asked to help a group of people in an institutional setting, they were all dehydrated. They just weren't drinking enough. And then I studied the scientific literature and I found out that every time you supposed to, let's just say for argument's sake, 70%, 72% of your body is water. But you're just not drinking because a part of your brain is not functioning in balance. You either suffer from hydrodipsia or polydipsia. One is you're drinking water when you already have enough, where your body needs water and you're not drinking. This is especially true in nursing homes. In fact, a nursing home director in New York came to see me in 1978, and he said that he was having trouble. Everybody in the nursing home just got worse and then died over a period of time. Was there anything that could change that? So I went about examining everything that occurs that goes wrong in an aging person's body. It took about 6 months, and then I gave him protocols. About 3 months later, he came back in, and just unannounced one evening, and there he was, and he said, I just want to tell you, this is really incredible. We have people who are actually better now than when they came into the nursing home 6 months ago, a year ago, and as a result, some of them may actually be able to go home. He said, I wanted to give you this information. I said, thank you. But one of the very first things he said was, we began regular hydration. We made sure that they had enough water in their body every day, because I didn't know that they weren't asking for water because their brain was telling them they didn't want water. As a result, they were grossly dehydrated. Yeah, some of these people were down around 30% body water. They should be dead. And by the way, long-distance runners, even regular runners, marathon runners, are frequently dehydrated because they're not drinking as much as what they're expending in perspiration and in creation of adenosine triphosphate when their body needs energy. In any case, just letting you know that you really need to be hydrated. You don't want your brain shrinking. You don't want your muscle shrinking. You don't want, you know, you don't want that dehydration phenomena. But in this particular study, those who had good levels of magnesium and were not suffering from any problems found that the greater the magnesium intake, the greater the brain volume, as well as a lower incidence of subclinical cerebrovascular disease. That's a stroke. The study included 1,466 participants with no history of stroke who had serum magnesium measurements and MRI scans. And they did this over a two-year period. And they averaged 76 years of age. And what they found was, give people more magnesium, and suddenly everything changes, especially in the frontal, temporal, and parietal lobe volumes. So that's one more reason to have your magnesium every day, twice a day, once in the morning, once in the evening. Now, also from Baylor College of Medicine, obesity harms your brain throughout your whole life. And yet scientists don't know why. You've heard me mention many times there is no such thing as being overweight and healthy. Now, granted, we should never shame someone because they're of their weight. But what happens is we've gone in the other direction. We are now praising people and saying to the new model, look at me, I'm overweight, but I'm a happy person. Okay, fine, that's good. But that doesn't mean you're healthy. And you shouldn't stop with the idea that, you know, now you're pleased with yourself. You're pleased with your body. Don't be, because you're not in a state of health. Psychologically, you're healthy, and that's good. And we support that completely. But there is no such thing. Let me repeat this. There is no such thing as being overweight and healthy. Now, if you take your blood pressure and your blood sugar, they may be normal, but that does not show you all of the different biochemical processes, including the pressure that the heart has to exercise in order to pump more blood out to handle this additional body weight. And all the studies show that, by the way. So, anyone who has put on a few too many pounds knows they can feel differently. It can slow you down. But over time, if those pounds grow into obesity, they're going to do serious harm, putting you at risk for a wide range of illnesses. But too much weight on the body also can harm your brain. That's what's new about this study. Research shows that obesity impacts brain health from childhood right through your life, affecting everything from executive function skills, the complex ability to initiate and plan and carry out tasks, to substantially raising dementia risk. By middle age, the consequences of excess weight are substantial. Several studies now have shown middle-aged adults who have body mass index, that's your BMI, above 30, and I believe it should be below 20, in the mid-teens, which qualifies as obesity, are more likely to get dementia than their healthier weight peers. And we right now have an epidemic of obesity in young people in the United States. Also, self-perceptions of aging and stress have significant impacts on physical health, according to an Oregon State University study. As adults, it's common to start thinking about how getting older affects your energy, your physical health, your cognitive well-being, and your body. I have a friend who's 83. Now, he is very healthy, and yet he keeps complaining about all the things that he doesn't like about his body. Gary, this is creepy skin that started on my knees, and now it's across my chest, and it's on my arms, and my muscle mass is no longer there. And I said, well, have you been going out to do your... Well, not, I haven't been doing the exercise, you know, COVID. Well, that'll cause that. So, but health-wise, he's probably in the 1% of healthy 83-year-olds in America, because he's doing a lot of stuff right. But again, when you start getting thinning of your hair, and by the way, thinning of the hair, I'm going to be presenting my hair protocol, which will take about 2 hours, maybe a little longer, in an upcoming webinar. Hopefully I'll plan it. I've got so much I'm doing right now, finishing two very important documentaries in the next 3 weeks, so I can present them. And if I can't find a theater to present them in New York, I'll do it as a webinar. The last one was enormously successful. A lot of people attended from all over the world. And so those are coming. But the one webinar I wanted to give you, I'm going to do one on cancer, I'm going to do one on heart disease, one obesity, I'm going to do one per month on those. These are going to be really comprehensive. And I'm going to have people who are experts in the field also join me on those as well, as I have the last three webinars. But take a look at my hair. If you remember, just 4 weeks ago, I'd cut it almost as tight as a crew cut. And every day, I don't blow out my hair. This is me getting out of the shower and just running my hands through it. And then every three times a week, I take the teaspoon of coconut oil, teaspoon of olive oil, rub them together, massage it into the hair, and it just really does wonders. But the protocol is 2 pages long, and see how thick my hair is. I mean, just take a look at it. This is the hair, right? And nails, pink, hard, and shiny. Nothing wrong. Same with the toenails. No funguses. Just that's the way it should be. So for those of you who've had problems in your skin also, because what helps the hair also is going to help the skin. I have a skin protocol, but the same protocol for the hair works for the skin. Look, I don't wear makeup. I got 500-watt lights in front of me. I got a high-definition camera, so there's nothing to hide. And the skin, no wrinkles, right? Smooth, tight, collagen, tight. You can do the same thing if you want to. So I'm going to put the hair and skin in the same protocol. I'll let you know when I'm going to do it. It's just finding the time to put all this in. But anyhow, this particular study at Oregon State University, found that our perceptions can change as we age, and almost always they're negative perceptions on all levels. And that's what they found when they did daily surveys for 100 days with older adults. And so what we need is positive self-perceptions as we age. All right? We need to look at the fact that we're older, but we're wiser. We've gone through a lot. We have survived a lot of crisis and loss. We've had to say goodbye. We've had to let stuff go. We've had to let people go. We've had to go through passages of life that we want to spend more time in, but the lights went out and we had to go to the next passage. There were times in our life where we had friends and a strong support system, people we loved and enjoyed being with, and they enjoyed us. Now, most of those are changed. And it's hard to make new friends, we think. It's not true, but we put that as a perception. And now loneliness. And with loneliness comes depression or angst. And then that further exacerbates our aging and speeds it up, because it creates cortisol and other stress hormones that overinflame our body, overinflame your cells, overinflame your brain. And then a lot of people get to a particular age, and doesn't have to be an old age, where they just say, what's the point? Why should I even get out of bed in the morning? What do I have to look forward to? I turn on the news. I'm depressed by what I see. I listen to opinion people just shouting out like they're in, you know, on a soapbox on Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park in London, where people can stand on a soapbox historically and give their grievances. Nobody cared. Nobody listened. What's the point? And then everything goes down. And that's not good. So I'm suggesting we start looking in the opposite direction. Wake up in the morning and say, I'm glad to be alive another day. Start looking at what I can do. What can I do in the next 24 hours that really shows that I'm respectful of having another day to live? And start reaching out to people. Form little groups, form support groups, not to complain and talk about what's wrong, but to say, what can we do that's right? I'll give you one example. How about those of you who are retired? You've mastered your careers. And what about all the younger people who could benefit from your advice? Why not pull together 4, 5, 10, 20 of you and then set up a system where you can have people who need your help contact you and you can give advice to people. That would be that you would be appreciated and they would be benefiting from you. I mean, that would be a wonderful way to get through a day. At the end of the day, you say, I helped a lot of people. That's a good thing. Isn't it part of the reason that we're alive is to be in service to others? And especially on the spiritual level, those who have less and those who are struggling. That's why I think you'll find my commentary interesting coming up about what we haven't done. Anyhow, let's have a better self-image of ourselves as we're aging. And we start exercising again, getting ourselves back into shape. There's a whole lot more we can do. And by the way, Harvard University, Harvard's medical school, just came out with a study, something you're most of you are into now, and that is a diet higher in nitrate from your green leafy vegetables like beets and Swiss chard, etc. All those vegetables you've been taking into your body every day, it lowers your risk of glaucoma. Yeah, greater intake of dietary nitrate also expands the capacity for the arteries to allow blood to flow through. Makes them more pliable. All that's good. In fact, it can give you up to 30% lower risk of primary open-angle glaucoma. This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, so the people said, what are you taking that stuff every morning for? That's just stupid quackery. No. That's based upon sound, peer-reviewed science. You're going to have better nitric oxide, gives you beneficial blood circulation, helps prevent strokes, heart attacks, allows you to live a longer life. You're on the right side of that. All right? That's the latest on health and healing. We're going now to the next part of our program where Richard Gale is going to join us, and we're going to offer a legitimate challenge, civil, to those who believe everything they read that supports the unvaccinated are the danger. And therefore, it's justified. Put them in a detention center. Take away their health insurance. Punish them. In the Los Angeles Times this week actually stated that mocking people who've died who are unvaccinated is a good thing. By no measure is that good. Shame on the Los Angeles Times and its entire editorial staff and all the people responsible for allowing that kind of hatred to go out. Wow. And exactly how much different are you than the alt-right? When it comes to demonizing people, you're demonizing someone and know nothing about them. You know nothing of what they really died from. Did they die of COVID or with COVID or from COVID? Did they have underlying conditions? You know nothing. You're making one broad generalization against all people. To mock people who have died for any reason is unethical. It's immoral. What have we become? Well, back in a moment. We're going to explore all this, and then you'll have...
And we know that the two doses of the vaccine offer very limited protection, if any. The three doses with a booster, they offer reasonable protection against hospitalization and deaths. Against deaths, I think, very good. Less protection against infection. Now, we are working on a new version of our vaccine, the 1.1, let me put it that way, that will cover Omicron as well. And, of course, we are waiting to have the final results. The vaccine will be ready in March.
You just heard for yourself. It's not speculative. It's not subjective. He stated, the head of Pfizer, and that's the vaccine many people received. You heard him say, so listen carefully, no one in the media will touch it, that the first two vaccines, little or no protection. All right? In effect, what if they said at the very beginning, a year ago, take these vaccines, we're going to make a lot of money, tens of billions of dollars, but they'll have little or no effect. You'll still be infected, and you can still spread infections. In fact, you will be the super spreaders, and that's the way it is. Oh, and the third booster, what did he say? Yeah, does little for infections. So there you have it. And yet nothing done about it. And they still want everyone to get the shots who are unvaccinated for any reason and every reason that you wouldn't get a shot, legitimate or not. You should get these little to no benefit shots. But then they're not telling you about the side effects. Richard Gale is here to discuss one little aspect of this. And by the way, we, Richard and I, have been working and are working on a major report. Hopefully it will be definitive up to this moment. We'll release it next week, where we are going through every single stage of the pandemic, showing you what was officially provided as the guidance and the demands that we all adhere to, and most people in the world did. They complied. And now we look back and we say, was that accurate or inaccurate? In every single instance, it was inaccurate. It was just, and I'm not even attributing motive. I'm even suggesting at this moment that they only had the best intents, not greed, not making a lot of money, not power over others. Set all that aside for the moment. They were still wrong on every single one of these. Nice to have you with us, Richard.
Yes, Gary. Can you hear me okay?
One of the biggest problems we face today, in fact, my friend Roy Tuckman out of KPFK asked me would I address something in detail, and that will be on our probably Tuesday program. It'll be in detail. It'll be a very long report, but with all citations, meaning peer review citations showing the truth. For example, there are studies out now showing, well, it's the unvaccinated going to the hospitals and getting sick and dying more than anybody else. Says who? Well, some reports in some of these scientific publications. There have been hundreds of thousands of publications. We're finding that most well-intentioned were using the wrong data, incomplete data. And I'll give you one example. And we will cite verbatim the actual quote from Columbia University. Richard Gale will do that and then give you an analysis why that's so important. We're said, well, you know, the vaccine injuries and deaths are very rare. Therefore, it's proof that those who've taken the vaccine and haven't gotten sick, it was the vaccine that prevented their sickness. That's not true at all. A little back story on this. In a moment, you're going to hear from two professors, two highly respected professors of evolutionary biology, scientists, who are going to take on just the PCR in a short clip. The longer clip of which they're citing is the interview that I did with Professor Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the PCR. Now the CDC officially is rescinding the use of the PCR test. That should have made headline news in every paper in the world. Why? Because virtually everybody has received the PCR test. What's wrong with that? That tells you if you're positive, and therefore the New York Times says if you're positive, you're a case. No, the New York Times is wrong, completely wrong. Why? Because, as Carrie Mullis showed, the PCR test cannot tell you whether you have the flu, influenza, or you have COVID. And if you have COVID, which COVID do you have? There are a lot of previous COVIDs. And is it new or is it something 10 years ago? Depends upon amplifications. Even Anthony Fauci stated that anything above 35 amplifications is in effect junk. So what has been the amplification of the average PCR? Around 43. That would mean then, extrapolating, that about 90% or more of all PCR tests were false positives. Think of what that does to a person when they're told they have a disease. Think of them being then quarantined. Think of what happens to their body, its immune system. Because anytime you tell someone they have cancer, heart disease, they're going to die or could die, their body reacts in a terrible way. But all that was false. So our entire premise of having a pandemic that everybody was equally responsible was false. Secondly, and I'm not going to go through all of them, we're going through all of them with citations, the actual peer-reviewed citations to prove this, is the death from COVID. The FDA actually has on its site the number of people who've died from COVID is about 6 to 7%. But we're told 100%. It's not true. And all the evidence shows that they were overstating all of the other causes of death, comorbidities, as if a person had a COVID a PCR test and tested positive, then if they had end-stage cancer, if they had end-stage emphysema, if they had end-stage heart disease, they died of COVID. That's fraudulent science. That's not by error. That's not by mistake. That's by intent. So some people needed to overinflate the figures in order to justify calling this a pandemic. Everybody must be vaccinated, no exceptions. But what if you are one of 130 million Americans who have autoimmune conditions? If you continue to allow up to 40 trillion of the spike protein to be created and put into the cells and to the ACE segment, then you're causing the body to create an immune response to that 24/7, and that could overstimulate the immune system to where the body's system begins to collapse, and we're seeing that. So those are just some of the issues. So then it comes to the figures. Which figures do you use? Richard, take it from there and cite the Columbia study and why all of the figures that have been based upon the VAERS system have been grossly, I mean grossly, as much as 98 to 99% inaccurate, according to Harvard University.
Yeah. Okay, so I think just before just mentioning the Columbia study, just for listeners to realize that the VAERS reporting system was never designed or intended to be a robust, accurate reporting system. So that's the first thing to realize. That was never its real intention, and it was never even submitted to healthcare professionals and hospitals and clinics and universities around the country as such. So there is a lot of errors. There's a lot of it's a cumbersome system. It is, people, healthcare professionals have complained often just about entering any kind of data into this. It's time consuming, which takes up on their more important issues that they've got, you know, in their clinics and in the hospital. So in Columbia University, well, we could begin with Harvard, because this was over a decade ago when Harvard did an evaluation of VAERS, and they came up with the estimate to only 1 to 2% of adverse vaccine-related injuries and deaths are being reported into VAERS. Okay, but more recently now, with there has been a very weak government effort to get people and get health professionals to report injuries into VAERS. However, the VAERS itself, they never improved upon it. So it's as bad today as it was over a decade ago. So when Columbia University, they did their evaluation, and their estimate was that only within a 7-month period, that would be from February to August of last year, that there are about 187,000 vaccine-related deaths. Should be reported in VAERS. So this is an increase by a factor of 20 over the CDC's figures of what they're reporting. What the Columbia researchers are most worried about is the vaccination of children, because their report states, this quote here, the risk of COVID vaccines and boosters outweigh the benefits in children, young adults, and older adults with low occupational risk or previous coronavirus exposure. So that would also previous meaning natural, having achieved natural immunity. I don't know if you want to get into that right now. And then their final conclusion was the VAERS database, the CDC's database, is unsuited for estimating life-threatening events or vaccine-induced fatality rates. And then we've had Jessica Rose on the show for a couple times now from the Institute for Pure Applied Knowledge in Israel. She's a kind of epidemiologist, statistician in infectious diseases. And her analysis is kind of in line with what Columbia. She was estimating that the vaccine death rate was really around 140,000, which is Columbia University's low figure. But she estimated the vaccine injuries are perhaps 41-fold higher than that being reported by the CDC. And then I think people should also realize that that's only what has been recorded in the database. That does not include the enormous backlog of vaccine injuries that have been reported, but have been entered, but have not been recorded. So there's this enormous backlog, and we don't know what kind of shenanigans might be behind that. So that's just concerning the VAERS database, Gary.
Okay, so just remember, all of the other publications using the VAERS system are going to report inaccurately. We probably have at least as many people who have been injured and died who have not gotten into the system yet because of the huge backlog, and who have not been reported at all as those who have been reported. And keep this in mind. In 1976, with the flu vaccine fiasco, 20 Americans died, 20 initially. It was later up to, I think, 51, and they banned the vaccine, 20. We're dealing with the government's own figures at up to 20,000, and that's at 1 to 2% accuracy. So you imagine the real figures, as Columbia was saying, it's well over 100,000, as Dr. Rose, well over 100,000, and yet we're not even considering banning it. We're mandating it. At the same time, the top person in the corporation that's making the vaccine is saying little to no benefit. His words, you have it. He said it. Now put those two together. You're taking something that he's saying could have little to no benefit, and then the adverse reactions, including permanent disability and death, and the permanent disabilities and injuries are over 1 million. And that's the government's own figures. So why isn't anyone demanding that these journals start doing their real homework? We're going to do that, and we're going to give you a very comprehensive article next week on this topic. Thank you very much, Richard Gale. Now, I wanted to finish off our series today of giving you some insights into the human condition and what we're all facing, because we're all facing this. And I just believe that we have to take a look at our obsessions with illusion. I even did a discussion lecture last night about how difficult it is for most people just to tell the truth. For example, how many people are working from home and are being paid for working 8 hours and don't work 8 hours? Do they tell their employer, you know, I work 3 hours today, I had other things to do, so pay me for the 3 hours? How many of those calls do you think ever happen? Good luck with that. There's an old English proverb. He who despises his own life is soon master of others. For the vast majority of Americans, the past year has been the most challenging in our lives. Certainly for young adults. However, not everyone has been suffering equally. The nation's health or illness is not uniform. Much of our suffering is dependent upon the institutionalization and negligence of previous injustices, the loss of social equanimity, economic disruptions in our lives, and our leaders' unmitigated greed in the pursuit of power. Left and right, doesn't matter who's in power. Nor is everyone adversely affected by the shifts underway in the imaginations of the political and ideological universes. The transnational class of corporate and banking elites, for example, has little motivation to respect or contribute to national boundaries and interests. When was the last time something was really made better for all of us? Where there was no, okay, you're going to get something better because of your race or because of your wealth or because of your social class. No, everybody improves. Where we took our resources and our mindset and we de-ghettoized an entire community. We re-industrialized many of the Rust Belt cities. Not once. For the last 40 years. Doesn't that tell you something? They perceive themselves as global actors for the generals and captains of neoliberal globalization, the puppet masters of financial markets. The COVID-19 pandemic only caused annoying disruptions in the quality of their lives. For the remainder of us, it has been cataclysmic in many instances. As we begin 2022, should we not pause and reflect carefully about what we want and what we don't want as individuals in our own lives? What are we willing to accept and what we must now begin to reject is no longer acceptable? How far are we supposed to maladapt to a society that is spiraling down while others watch this from the security of their safe elite places? We do not have a secure, sustainable future at this moment, anything but. And yet we're not acting in a way that secures a sustainable future. Fundamentally, there is a deep introspection in the common and moral principles we are living today that we must engage in. We must have civil, open, honest communication of what our needs are as a society, individually. Your needs, my needs, the average person's needs, nobody asks, nobody cares. It is not what we say or profess, but what we actualize in our daily lives and as a collective society that matters. Only our actions can realistically convey the deeper values in the American psyche. Therefore, we need to ask ourselves more difficult questions to discover the real moral poverty that defines us as a civilization. Not everyone, but a lot. Where were the large demonstrations against the $1 trillion bailout of all the Wall Street firms and many of the major corporations in America and even foreign banks? But none of us got a penny. No, we lost our homes. We lost everything. More than 20 million Americans were made homeless. Not a tear was shed in Wall Street, nor in Washington. Nobody cared about our suffering day to day. We were invisible, but their friends and the lobbyists, oh, they were there knocking on the door saying, remember us? Remember how much money we gave you in your campaign to get reelected? Well, we need this at this moment. And they got it, more than what they even asked. We were given nothing. Small businesses, nothing. Where were the demonstrations against home foreclosures and the loss of small family farms? None. How about the debt drenched student loan aid? Nothing. How about exploitive payday loans where you could pay 1,000% interest? Or exorbitant credit card fees? Nothing. There were no protests against Obama's broken promises on universal health care. The single-minded attention on the pandemic has canceled out 2.5 million homeless Americans. Yes, that's how many we have. 2.5 children who are homeless in America. And 46 million adults and children go hungry every day. Where was the collective voice condemning the hundreds of billions of tax dollars to increase the power of the military and the intelligence complexes as American cities further collapsed into ghettos? Nothing. Where were the marches against corporations offshoring jobs by the millions? They were lauded. They were not criticized. Why no vocal outrage against Obama's invasion of Libya and Syria? And Hillary Clinton, who I believe will run for president again, that'll be interesting. Just my thoughts. But when she was laughing and cackling at the death of Gaddafi, quite simply, the one person in all of Africa, the 54 countries of Africa, who was going to break the stranglehold of the American dollar as the reserve currency, instead have the gold denier replace it, giving financial sovereignty and independence to all the African nations. They killed him for it. He was sodomized with a bayonet. But that was funny to Clinton. Did she or Obama or anyone apologize for all the death and destruction? Do you want to go to Libya today? It is the largest open-air slave market in the world. For those who are against slavery, and everybody should be, then why aren't they looking at where their clothes are made? Most clothes are made in Bangladesh, where they make 28 cents an hour, have the shortest work lifespan in the world, and are treated inhumanely. So we can get great bargains on clothes? Where's our outrage? It's selective. And what about supporting rogue dictatorships that are virtually demonic in their attitudes, such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, for crimes against humanity? We offer no crimes against humanity. To the contrary, we make Saudi Arabia, for a period at the UN, the head of the Human Rights Commission. Well, that's something. That was in a year when they beheaded more people, threw more gays off buildings tied to chairs, and whipped more people, in the women in particular, in public view, than any other country in the world. So, that shows you how important the UN is, and that shows you how important in human rights Saudi Arabia is. What a world we live in. And where were the protests? Where were the demonstrations? There were none. Where are the protests against corporations exploiting slave labor in poor countries such as Bangladesh and Indonesia and in China? Think of the irony of all of the outspoken athletes like LeBron James, who gets millions of dollars for products made under slave labor in China. Any irony there? None. Let the checks be written and the agents smile, and they can buy more of whatever they want. But don't look at the consequences to someone else for where it came from. No, there were no noteworthy protests for any of these issues. And if these are true existential threats to our very democracy. Bertrand Russell wrote, "One should care about the world they do not see. We do not. We only care about what we see and hear and experience second to second. What's happening in Libya, we don't care about. What's happening in Yemen with all the millions of children starving to death, dying of dysentery, we don't care about. How about Haiti? We don't care about that. We never have. Oh, unless the Clintons can exploit it, as they do everything, for their foundation. But let's not investigate the foundation. Let's certainly not criticize anyone. The deep state wouldn't like that, especially those who are the harbingers of positive outcomes for corporate America. Do you think anybody would get a $500,000 lecture fee for a boring 40-minute lecture that means nothing? That's the quid pro quo. That's the payback. You give us what we want, forever in your life, When you need money, come to us. We'll give you an afternoon, 40 minutes, put a big check in your bank account. And that's what happens. Ask how many people came to Congress who are moderate in their income and are now worth tens of millions, and Nancy Pelosi, over $100 million. That's the world we live in. Should we not therefore be planning ahead for the future of our children, grandchildren, and ourselves instead of being incapacitated by fear? We should be, but we're not. The national popular disinterest in these and other crises forebodes something on the horizon that does not bode well for most Americans. It is a simple principle to understand, yet so subtle it will likely go unnoticed until everyone is individually and collectively affected. It is the utter lack of a balance within the national body politic and across the media that spoon-feeds us virtual images of a faux theatrical play, the illusionary icons on our minds, monitor screens that we cannot escape, that shape our perceptions of reality. Our reality is created outside of ourselves, and then we personalize it. And it's controlled. This is how control is exerted over our thoughts, speech, and actions. In fact, it is only after people exercise their thoughts independently with a certain belief that they have actual self-control over their lives that they arrive at the realization that their perceptions may be largely distorted, even unconsciously. Throughout America's history, there have always been systems of three federal branches to assure that there is a platform for checks and balances, as well as a structure to contain the tensions between them. That system now is being rapidly challenged and in eroding. Now the middle of the mad pack, and these are the middle road Democrats, officially control the White House and both legislative bodies. And look at what they've been producing. No less than what would happen when the House, the Senate, and the White House were controlled by the Republicans. They are all against the people because nothing they produce actually works. There's also what is commonly referred to as the Fourth Estate, the powers of the press and news media that control the framing of the political narrative and the partisan issues. In the past, the media was expected to hold the government accountable by exposing its conflicts of interest that endanger the public, its misdemeanors and systemic corruption. This, too, no longer exists. You can do anything. You can commit almost any crime against the public, against the Constitution, and the media will simply say, let's turn this around to make it look like it's other. This is the rot, the decay, as the media has been fully captured by corporate interest and now aligns itself politically and ideologically with the new political elite determined to reshape democracy and launch a new reset that will dramatically infringe upon individual rights and liberties. We are looking at East Germany becoming the new America, or we becoming the old East Germany. Finally, there is the growing influence of a fourth branch of government, the corporatocracy, and its private interest. We might also include the U.S. intelligence community that increasingly operates independently from any standards whatsoever. We even have members of the deep state, the CIA, and the National Security Agency, Clapper and Brennan, lie under oath before Congress, and not a single thing is said not to hold them accountable. Nothing. Together, we can witness this loose cabal of seemingly independent entities working simultaneously in consortium and in opposition to each other, propelling us towards a future tsunami of greater polarization and immense social disruption. Earlier generations were not threatened by the telecommunications and technological giants like Google, Facebook, and Amazon. Clinton's Communications Decency Act of 1996, despite its well-meaning intention to protect free speech, was otherwise destructively naive. At that time, it was sensible. However, that was before the advent of the social media that now dominates our lives and shapes political discourse. Silicon Valley has become a force far more powerful than the lobbyist on K Street to ensure that corporate Democrats are raised to a position of absolute power. That is not healthy.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. The Supreme Court struck down a vaccine mandate for employees of large businesses yesterday, but allowed a separate mandate specifically targeting healthcare workers to remain in effect. In a 6-3 ruling, the court said the Biden administration overstepped its authority by imposing a rule that businesses with at least 100 employees require vaccination or weekly testing. That rule would have affected more than 80 million private sector employees. The court's three liberal justices wrote in dissent that the court was itself overreaching by striking down the mandate. The separate mandate for healthcare workers survived on a narrow 5-4 vote, with conservatives John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh joining the liberal justices. That mandate requires workers at healthcare facilities receiving federal funding to get inoculated while allowing for religious and medical exemptions. In a deepening of our nation's political divide, the RNC threatened to bar Republicans from election year debates in a letter that Chair Rona McDaniel sent to the Nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. The RNC's concerns include the timing of the first presidential debate, changes to formats and conditions in some cases without notifying candidates, and potential conflicts of interest among debate moderators. Those concerns echo complaints made by former President Trump, who repeatedly accused the commission of unfair treatment. Trump ultimately refused to participate in the second 2020 debate because he objected to it being held virtually because of the pandemic. New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman, who initially broke the story, suggested the RNC's threat is a preemptive measure and an indicator that former President Trump is set to run in 2024. Today, Stuart Rhodes, the founder of the right-wing militia group, the Oath Keepers, makes his first appearance in court. The Justice Department on Thursday charged 11 people, including Rhodes, with seditious conspiracy, the most serious charges brought to date relating to the riot. Stuart Rhodes was arrested in Texas on Thursday morning, the Justice Department said. In a 48-page indictment, prosecutors detailed how Rhodes and his co-conspirators allegedly planned to stop the transfer of power when President Biden would be sworn into office. Quote, they coordinated travel across the country to enter Washington, D.C., equipped themselves with a variety of weapons, donned combat and tactical gear, and were prepared to answer Rhodes' call to take up arms at his direction. Some co-conspirators also amassed firearms on the outskirts of Washington, D.C., distributed them among quick reaction force teams, and planned to use the firearms in support of their plot to stop the lawful transfer of presidential power. Close quote. In related news, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol subpoenaed some of the country's largest social media and tech companies Thursday after receiving what was described as inadequate responses to an August request for information. The four subpoenas were sent to Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, and Alphabet, the parent company of both Google and YouTube. The committee is demanding records related to the spread of misinformation, efforts to overturn the 2020 election, domestic extremism, and foreign influence in the 2020 election. Investigators also want information on how the company's algorithms boosted that kind of content and changes made since the attack. The companies have until January 27 to comply.